101.5 FM, online at 1015thehawk.ca.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Chelsea Edwards, a programming coordinator at the Parkwood Gardens Neighborhood Group in Guelph. This interview was originally recorded on June 11th, 2020. So to start with, would you like to introduce yourself for listeners?
Okay, my name is Chelsea Edwards. I went to the University of Guelph. I graduated in 2018. I am a first-generation immigrant from Jamaica, so I've been here almost 15 years now, so that's pretty cool. And I've been living in Guelph for the last 2 years after I finished my degree, just because I felt like this was a good place for me to sort of learn more about myself and set up who I wanted to be separate from my family. And this is a good place to learn how to grow.
Awesome. Where is the rest of your family living out of?
So my family is really scattered. We're actually like a lot of diaspora families where migration patterns depended on educational pathways. So my mom and my sister were both originally educated in Jamaica at the University of the West Indies, but my sister got an opportunity in England. So my sister's in England. My mom and I moved to Canada. My mom's side of the family and my dad's side of the family both live in different places. So half of my dad's family lives here in Canada. The rest is scattered across the states and some still stationed on the island. And then it's the same with my mom's family, with more people being scattered across Europe. So we've got family members who are living in Hungary. We've got family members who live in Miami. We've got family members who, you know, travel all over. So it's hard to pin everyone down all the time.
Well, that immediately has me go on like a spin-off topic in my mind, that in a time like a global pandemic, when folks are asked to stay put where they call home at the moment, and where even the concept of neighbors or friends in your own town in a way could feel as far away as people halfway across the world if something like Zoom or Skype is the only way you can see them. Is it weirdly possible to be closer to your family during a time where it's become more normal to talk online?
Absolutely. I've noticed that my contact with all of my family members has gone up the longer that quarantine has gone on and the more quarantine has spread. I think it has to do with you have to now build the time in for online communication. What I found, even with my mom lives in Toronto, just communicating with her was really difficult because I've got my life here. I've got my job, I've got my friends, I've got my social circle, and she's got her own life. And so what ends up happening is when you're out in the world dealing with people, you don't really build in time to get on your phone and FaceTime and Snapchat and all that stuff. But with the quarantine, that's the only way you're going to communicate with anyone, even if they are living 2 blocks away from you. So I now have a weekly appointment with my mom and my sister, and now I can sit and talk to my mom for 3 hours a night without feeling like I'm, you know, missing out on something or losing something else, which I think is great. But it also calls into question how much of that family bond do we sacrifice by not being close to the people next to us, and how to merge that in-person interaction and online interaction.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I think one of the things I noticed was just before I would have felt guilty choosing an online relationship over an in-person one, especially, you know, when you go out to an event and see a person chatting with someone on their phone or texting someone who isn't there, and it feels like such a bad social faux pas that, like, what, none of us are good enough who you're actually with, and now none of that guilt exists. Has it reframed for you what going back would look like in terms of if you get to return to in-person gatherings, still creating space or prioritizing differently around the social part?
What I like to think of this as is a huge experiment in what the next 100 years of humanity is going to look like. I think what we witnessed, especially from even looking at my own electronics within the last 10 to 15 years, was just this rapid explosion of social media, of, you know, internet usage, of internet access. And so our social dynamics didn't change. You're always taught that it's important when you're talking to someone to look them in the eye and to, you know, turn your body towards them. And this is what active listening is. And no one taught me active listening over the internet. So I can't do that over the internet. So with active listening, I don't know how far into the Ontario curriculum it is, but I know it's part of the high school curriculum. And I know that we teach kids, you know, when someone's speaking, especially public speaking, you listen to them and that's the only person you pay attention to. And that's why so many people get in trouble for having phones in the classroom or having any type of electronics. But we're starting to realize that it's going to be a part of our lives for the rest of humanity. We're not going to get rid of technology. We're only going to advance it. And now we need to start teaching not just kids, but adults as well, how to have that interaction online and make it just as personable as having it in person.
It's interesting. What it reminds me of is, I think I'm probably like the better part of 10 years older than you, if I was to guess. I'm 35.
Yes, I'm 24.
Yeah. So in grade 9 and 10, we still had typing class. And I remember that we got a lot of pushback because we were supposed to stare at the screen and have our hands in a very specific placement on the keyboard. And there was this whole QWERTY thing, these practices. But our generation was like the first to have access to the internet. And so we'd go home and we'd be chatting with each other or strangers every night. So our typing skills became so fast. But it was a mix of glancing at the keys, glancing up. It wasn't this old school. And it was really weird because the teachers didn't know how to respond. In one way, we were learning faster than ever, but it was completely different than everything that had been taught, every formal structure. And yeah, there is something to be said for accepting when a generation has leaned into a technology in a different way. And then like, okay, how can we embrace the approach that's working and then reframe it so they're still using it like respectfully or safely? Mm-hmm. And I hadn't thought about that with the social dynamics.
Yeah, especially with when we look at how social media has expanded over just the quarantine, the amount of kids that are now on Instagram, on TikTok, even on Twitter, I've seen more, the age use go down just a little bit, the average age use. It's important to build that into our social dynamics as well. You know, that 150, I know it's more than 150 now, but the 150 characters doesn't leave a lot of room for interpretation. And it's the same thing with the internet. Even with something like this, with Zoom, you don't really get the full body picture. So you have to make your emotions and make your points without losing you behind the words is such an important lesson that I don't know if we've even begun.
Yeah. I had a teenage guest last week, and he brought up a point that was super interesting to me around the effect that the feedback of, like, when you do something online or you post something and a lot of people like it, and then the opposite, right? If you post something and it has very little response, how that's affecting sort of the identity of these teenagers when they're trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work and how to fit in. They have like a completely different measure for what that looks like, but one that can easily be manipulated by people who have control over those systems and how they're not being taught about that at all.
Yeah, it's a little bit worrying sometimes because I've noticed it a lot with my own, over the quarantine, I've taken time to look back at my experiences, especially with the internet. So you mentioned that we're about 10 years apart. My first experiences with learning about the internet were about grade 5, grade 6. We did typing classes, you know, the ABC, you follow the dinosaur that moves along. But I also had a computer in my room. My mom bought me, well, we actually had it donated to us, but she gave me money for the Scholastic's Fair as well to buy like Roller Coaster Tycoon and The Sims. So I wasn't connected to the internet, but the computer was a huge part of my childhood experiences. And then once we got our desktop computer, that's when, you know, grade 7, grade 8, when I started to explore the internet. And it was unregulated. I could find whatever I wanted. And I did find whatever I wanted. And, you know, when I hit, I want to say middle school age is when they started talking about cyberbullying more in schools. And they started having lessons during civics classes about, you know, when you're going online, how to get online, how to protect your password, stuff like that. I don't think that lesson has changed since I've left high school from all of my friends who have moved into the education system. And that's a real failure on the part of the education system because it's really scary out there. Even as someone my age at 24, aside from all of the content, the people are not as authentic as in person. With in-person interactions, you sort of have that watchability and people are always looking around you. The internet, you can find anyone from anywhere. And that's kind of the problem. You could be talking to someone on the other side of the globe and have no idea who they are, what they actually do. And if their intent is not to be kind to you, then you'll never actually know that. And that's something that I wish we would tell teenagers. So even if you are talking to another teenager, you have no idea what their life experiences are. You don't know what really is leading them online. Yes, you should go into most of your online interactions open and, you know, trying to have fun, but you do need to have that same stranger danger learning curve that we put kids through in terms of walking by yourself when you're going home. Is the same thing with surfing the web.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole side of folks who may have a malicious intent, but I think there's also an additional thing, which is I think people sometimes feel like they can dump their thoughts there and walk away, and they don't have to face any consequences if they don't want to. So people who are just want an outlet for real life feelings and can't get away with it in class or with their friends will like throw that on someone else online, and there's like very little accountability.
What I always like to tell people is that the internet is not your diary, because unlike your diary, you can close it, put it away, and no one else might see it for years, but anyone can search your name. The Wayback Machine is a huge part of the internet. It's an archive of everything, and that's what we're seeing with cancel culture. I know a lot of people don't like cancel culture because it's essentially public hangings.
What is the term you're saying? Cancel culture?
Yes, cancel culture. So it's the idea that when someone does something online, whether it's in the past, present, or distant past, the community will decide whether or not they want to continue interacting with that artist or creator or person. Okay. So what you're seeing when teachers who comment racist things online lose their jobs is an effect of cancel culture. But that also applies to celebrities, regular everyday people, politicians, just anyone and anybody who can be judged will be judged. But I'm a criminal justice major, so I love cancel culture because it's essentially a base form of a justice system. It's a collective of not just everyone in your neighborhood or 12 random people from your community. It is everyone across the world who could potentially be affected by what you've put out on the internet, speaking up and having their voice heard. And some of those voices are more passionate than others. And that's when you see people starting to lose their jobs in real life, or, you know, celebrities starting to lose endorsements in real life because cancel culture really is a judicial system, and we just haven't worked out the laws to be able to set it in stone, but it is something that anyone can get caught up in. And that's something that we need to teach the kids, because if you don't teach them in a offline setting, they'll learn it online. It's sort of lawless online. It can be morphed into anything.
Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating about that is, like, certain things you need to have licenses to do, right? And then it's like you need to have a license to have a firearm. If you're somewhere that you're even allowed to have a firearm, you need to have a license to drive a car. So it's sort of assumed within that that you've gone through certain steps to prove that you deserve to have access to this potentially very dangerous thing that you're going to do. And therefore, if you are irresponsible with it, you are held accountable. It is an interesting thing to me that we're going to see a generation of young people turn into old people who past mistakes or past blunders as a young, uneducated person in terms of what the internet really holds will still come back to haunt them. And there is no license for the internet. There is no proven steps you went through to be given permission to be there. And so, you know, the mom in me is mortified at the idea of my children being forever held accountable to things they say right now at 11 and 8 years old. But I do agree with you that you can't use ignorance, especially if you've chosen to stay ignorant, as an excuse to be a jerk forever, you know, or ever. And so, you know, when there's these like terribly offensive photos that pop up for politicians and stuff, it's a completely different category than a child saying more than they should have on a chat group. But I don't know where the line is when we haven't built in any kind of regulations or education around it.
And the scariest part is, I don't know if we can build regulations around it. It would require bipartisan international support that we've never seen before. Well, I won't say we've never seen it before, that we saw with this pandemic. That sort of international immediate spread of sort of code of ethics across the internet would require a huge overhaul that all international leaders and all international communities participate in. And we are sort of seeing the baselines of that drawn. So I would say the base rules are no sexism, but then you start to get into different realms of, well, what about in comedy? What if it's satire? What if it's this? What I'm interested in is what privacy entails on the internet and how to protect your privacy on the internet, because I agree that kids shouldn't be held accountable for everything they've ever said in their entire lives. It's a bit redundant because it stops growth. It truthfully will stop growth if we don't learn how to rein in our personal cancel culture. What I find is that international cancel culture, where you've got, you know, kids from Japan commenting on something that you've done, it's a lot more of the bigger issues. So like I mentioned, no sexism, no racism, no homophobia. Those issues will definitely get you internationally canceled. But once you're dealing with interpersonal situations, it's more of a, like, what that group decides as to cancel. So your friends at school could cancel you because you wore a yellow shirt, and that's not right, and that shouldn't be left up on the internet for you to be judged for or for your friends to be judged for. And so learning how to set privacy regulations around people who are under 18, you know, people who are under 18 is very difficult, because the usual minimum age for social media sites like Twitter, like Facebook, is 13 years old.
Oh, wow.
So if there is someone under the age of 13 there's no protocol set in place other than just the complete removal of their account. But that does not talk about removing it from the Wayback Machine or removing it from the archives, or even trying to, if you do preserve it, protect the identity of the person inside the account. And I don't know if we can rely on our governments or even our service providers to set up protocols for who the internet should be available for. And as we start to move education online, that's going to be a big issue, is how do you prevent the privacy of someone who's under the age of 18 from being violated? And not just violated now, violated 20, 30, 40, 100, 300, because the internet's not going anywhere. It's just going to expand. And once it expands, how far back in someone's history will you be able to go? And where will you stop?
Yeah, it's interesting because it feels like since the internet began, my philosophy for my own sake was just assume every single thing you say or look at or do is public. So just imagine if like literally everyone in the world could be watching, and that's my filter for all things, right? So it's like any photo that goes up, no matter what the privacy settings are, just if I can assume this is something I would do with the whole world watching. But, you know, that is good to a point. That's probably like a healthy framework for it, probably closer to realistic. But it's not like every single thing you've ever been okay with everyone seeing is something you want everyone to look at all the time. It's not like things from the past are necessarily embarrassing, but they may not be where I'm at anymore, right? And so the idea that you can't ever change or move on is a weird one. Like not even just counting like offensive stuff that you'd rather leave behind, but just any decisions you made creatively or anything. It's weird that it's all somewhere, and that you could meet someone on the street and share your name, and then that person can go deep creep for as long as they want. You know, takes away the opportunity to build a relationship on your terms and share what you want to with that person.
It's crazy because I don't want to use the word interested or worried, because I'm not either, but I am curious to see how the spike in OnlyFans use and Pornhub use is going to affect people's career. Is this going to be the end of puritanical beliefs reigning over our lives, which I would, you know, finally? Or are there going to be a lot of women and men who are ostracized years from now for a decision that they made to participate in an industry that is booming? You know, these industries, online sex work is huge, but our legal systems around sex work haven't changed. So with things like that, are people going to be running for office and have their, you know, their old Pornhub videos or their old OnlyFans videos out for everyone to see?
Yeah. And what happens if things are legal and then later aren't, you know, or fall out of favor? Yeah, it's like you can't know how long something will stay an acceptable and non-embarrassing thing. I mean, I already think that like any workplace that did a giant song and dance together in the early 2000s is probably embarrassed to watch that now. And it, you know, was never illegal, but...
And there's so many other things, you know, like I started my Instagram in my grade 11 year. So my mom was very much against me having any social media. And that probably saved me a lot of headache and heartache during high school, because I didn't have any way for anyone to contact me other on my phone that didn't have minutes. So it's interesting to see how rapid the change has been, because I've only been out of high school for six, seven years now. The privacy ways that people view the internet have changed. The ways that people view things that you post on the internet has changed rapidly in the last 6 years. So I really hope that as we continue to advance with the internet, and as we secure internet rights for everyone, not just for people in the Western world or wealthy people, we see a change in our dynamics and our understanding of people's pasts, and we become a little bit more accepting, or it's just going to be a complete disaster for everyone.
Well, one thing that this has me thinking of is, if you are a kid who is not allowed to go on, doesn't have any kind of social media profile because you're not allowed to, maybe doesn't even have the internet at home, and the framework for you growing up, it kind of reminds me of like homeschooled versus public school or something, where like if a lot of your development is in a form of isolation, or at least like isolated in certain ways. And what like, is missing when you're an adult, or what learning you need to do at a totally different point in time to put in some of those missing pieces. Like, even a friend of mine who went to Catholic school versus public school was missing all kinds of, like, television shows from our youth, like that kind of thing that has a surprisingly long impact, like a lifelong impact in some cases of some jokes that that person will never get, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, it seems like it could leave a child behind for them to have zero relationship in the fundamental aging years of their youth to the internet. And in another way, I picture, like, if you're a kid who lives in a small town and you haven't found anyone like you, the internet presenting you with people like you halfway across the world can be the difference of you feeling like you literally are alone in this world versus I just have to get to this point where I can, like, move to a city like that and that's where I'll find my people. And, like, there's so many positive aspects to it, but it also feels like there was so much to be said for when I was young, you had to figure out if you weren't going to fit in, then you had to navigate that. Mm-hmm. And in real time, in person time, in accountable, physical, like, right there ways, you didn't get to express your rage at being a loner or an outsider by mm-hmm. yelling at the internet, you know, and putting it there. Like, that just didn't exist. And so it's just so complicated mm-hmm. figuring out, like, where the balance is of, like, how much good it could do for a child who feels lonely versus how much it can become, like, a weird sounding board or, like, just something that, I don't know, that you can just walk away from all of the troubles of real life.
Mm-hmm. And it depends on the usage as well. And it also depends on the in real life reality of that child. It, so much goes into how internet usage impacts someone's day-to-day life that you never really know how it's going to work out in the end. I can speak to my experiences. The internet, I think, personally saved my life as a kid. I became I don't know if you know the term latchkey kid, or it's just the term where the kid turns the key by themselves and goes home by themselves. So when I go home by after school, there was no one there. My mom used to work nights, well, into the night. She'd work all day. And I would come home and I'd stay in our apartment by ourselves. And then even in high school, I would be by myself or come home after volunteering. And I would go on the internet. That was, like, my first thing. After I finished my homework, Tumblr was the big thing on the time. You know, you get on Tumblr and you just scroll through pictures. And that's where I found my love for comic books. That's where I found my love for true crime. That's where I explored every single question I ever wanted to ask ever about anything, whatever topic I wanted to ask. But then you do have to think about that internal monitoring. So there were times where I did not have internal monitoring. That time on Tumblr, there was a lot of, it's called pro Anna and pro Mia, which is pro anorexia and pro bulimia. And that was really popular. It was like the thigh gap era. It became really big offline as well, but online it was dangerous. And you would see blog on top of blog on top of blog of girls starving themselves, of girls doing different binging and purging methods, of all sorts of, like, sexualized images of teenagers. And I was a teen at the time. I remember going on those posts and becoming very body conscious. And I was a bigger girl. And I was also one of the only Black girls in my community. And so that community online was also all white, thin, middle-class girls, teenage girls online. And it was just very confusing. And only when I severed that contact, when I, like, closed off Tumblr and went downstairs to hang out with my mom, would I snap back into reality. And we have to realize that some people don't have that draw, that something that will pull them back to earth when they hit reality. And I think the most extreme form of that we see on the internet is the incels. And Canada really, I wish Canada would have a very serious conversation around male mental health, because I've had male friends tell me how easy it is as a guy when you're not dating. A lot of people our age aren't dating seriously or to get married. It's just not a financial situation that a lot of people are in. And a lot of young women are trying to discover themselves before marriage. And so what you end up finding is a lot of men are dealing with issues where they don't have other men to talk to. So they get online and the feedback loop is not healthy at all. And with what we're seeing with the influx of crime in Canada, or terrorist crime, is incel crime. And I'm very proud of the Canadian government for starting to label certain things as incel crime faster than other governments. But we need to start talking about teenage boys and men in universities, because that feedback loop is so important. And if you don't teach them, hey, yes, it's okay to go online and you and a bunch of your group complain about how hard it is to date, that's okay. But if you're planning to hurt people because of that, then there needs to be something in place to help. And I don't know if anyone has any idea of what that should look like.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Chelsea Edwards, a programming coordinator at the Parkwood Gardens Neighborhood Group in Guelph.
Yeah, it's very tricky. I remember once taking my kids to a beach, and it was maybe the busiest beach I'd ever brought them to. And it was just a total nightmare moment as a mom, because everywhere I looked were kids doing everything wrong. And then I had this like sweet little kid of my own who's just like so confused, because it's like maybe I had done all kinds of right things, but we weren't living alone in this world. We had to share this beach, this, you know, in this case, a very literal beach, with everybody else, regardless of the decisions they are making. And I remember thinking, like, if I could just go to my own beach with my kids, we'd be fine. But it was kind of eye-opening. It was one of my first moments where I realized just how little control I was going to have anytime I let them go out in the world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a responsibility for us to each be doing that work for our own children. But if there was a more kind of universal, like at like the school level, and implemented instruction and education around this, there'd maybe be a few more common practices across a broader group of people, right?
And it's hard, because where do you draw the line of how much you're going to teach in person and how much you're going to let someone just discover and set for themselves? Mm-hmm. Because if you have to set the morality for every single person that goes online, you're taking on something way bigger than you can handle.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of people doing the work right now of trying to learn how they would teach this type of education?
From what I've seen and from what I've experienced in my own job, especially those who are dealing with under the age of 16, I've seen a huge change in understanding of, okay, the internet is something that you get exposed to almost immediately now. You know, the first things parents will do is buy a baby iPad and just let the kids learn through that, which is great because it's opened up education. But it means that now the education system and those who work with kids have to take on that mandate and have to do the work themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a bit about your profession, because you went through school in criminal justice, but I don't believe that's specifically what you're working in now.
No, I'm working as a program coordinator with Parkwood Garden. It's the neighborhood group for the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition, and it's over on the West End next to Costco. That's where I work. And I just help with facilitating and designing programming, and I focus mostly on the, I want to say, 13 to 18 range. That's sort of my sweet spot, but the programs cover from K to 12.
Okay. And so the stuff you're talking about, like internet awareness and everything, this is already playing into your own profession, right?
Absolutely. So for the summer, we're looking to design an online summer experience, which is something that is a lot more complicated than I thought it was going to be. Not just because you have to think about, okay, how do I set up online? How do I run this Zoom stuff? But also, you have to be built into whatever you teach kids to go online with, because if you are the first reason they get online, you are the first experience they're going to have. And therefore, it's my responsibility to teach them how to continue to surf the web outside of our program with the same safety.
Hmm. And is this kind of like a learning as you go? Like, have you spent a lot of time leading up to this with these types of thoughts? Or is this like, you have to learn this now under the circumstances?
I think it's a combination of both. I will give big props to the Ontario teachers for really pushing for online education for the last couple of years. For an expansion of online education and an integration into the classroom. So with smart boards, stuff like that. So even when I was in high school, I had already begun learning some of the stuff that I'd like to incorporate into the program, whether it was, you know, critically thinking about the emails that you're getting, or even if you don't have an email, critically thinking about the messages that you're receiving, who's sending you the messages. So I would say that there's different components from different areas that have already been built in, but a lot of it is new, and that has to do mostly with the fact that we don't know when in-person things are going to restart, and so you're essentially building these new systems as not replacements, but just adjacent systems to the already existent school system, and therefore you have to re-bring those policies into that new system after assessing whether or not they're appropriate.
Wow. That seems like a lot.
It is. It's a lot. And it's not going to be perfect. And I think that's one thing a lot of people are not willing to accept. And that's what I'm really worried about, is that, you know, things are going to slip through the cracks. Not everyone is on board with the change. It's going to be a difficult setup.
What are some of the ideas that you've had for the online summer experience?
So one of the biggest things is personal development for me. I think there's not a lot of personal development opportunities for kids or for people who are in that 13 to 16 age. It's sort of like, decide. Decide right now, which is unfair, but it makes sense, because at 24, I'm like, man, I really should have decided at 19 what I'm going to do, because I don't want to decide. So what we're looking to do is just sort of facilitate that expansion of personal knowledge. So a lot of self-care, learning what makes you anxious, what makes you stressed out, what makes you sad, what makes you happy, and putting together a plan for when things don't work out perfectly as you wanted them to. And then also developing personal interests. And that will be individual to each child, but that's something that I also like to build into the program. Because what else are you going to do other than develop your own personal interests? Next, you're going to spend your whole life living for other people. So,
is there an element of the youth in that neighborhood interacting with each other digitally alongside this, so that there's still like the role of other human beings? Or since it's online, is it like more of a portal to the broader world?
It's a difficult situation to understand, because we as a neighborhood group or as a professional organization won't be able to go into their personal communications and understand how well they're communicating. But what we're trying to do is attempt to facilitate that same leader-led activity, but child sort of organized situation that you get when you run a summer camp or when you run any kind of activity with kids. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they're just going to take over. And you just have to set the program and hope they follow it. And if they don't, just follow along with what they'd like to go with. So what I'm trying to create and what our whole team is trying to create across Guelph with any of the programs we're putting together is just facilitating any type of contact. So we have our ideas of how we'd like to run them, but it'll truthfully be up to the participants.
So are similar programs are being attempted to be implemented in other neighborhood groups as well?
Mm-hmm. It's a learning process of how to put those programs together, especially because the recommendations change every day and the access changes every day. So the city is closed until September 8th, but you still might be able to use the schools. You might not be able to have more than 5 kids, but the city is saying you might be able to have 10. So right now, I think a lot of people are trying to put together some form of an in-person situation, whether it's a one-day event that you can come to the park and experience, or a once-a-week event, or a daily thing. I think they're just trying to figure out right now what the actual suggestions are and what. So we just saw today Toronto is making face coverings mandatory, and that they'll be handing out 1 million face masks. But, you know, what if it's mandatory in Toronto, does that mean anybody who's traveling throughout the GTA, which unfortunately I'm going to have to lump Guelph into the GTA now, does that mean that our towns are going to have to follow the same sort of precautions? So it's a lot of that. I think a lot of people are also afraid of doing it online only because we have to face the reality that not everyone has unlimited internet access. Internet access in Canada is the highest priced in the entire world, and the lowest quality. It makes me so upset. I don't mind paying $70 a month if I'm getting the best quality. So what we find is, there's some families within our own neighborhoods here in Guelph that don't have full unregulated, or not unregulated, but unprohibited access to the internet. And there are families where someone is going to be working on the only computer available for the entire household all day. So it's a balance of trying to provide online programs, but understanding that online can't be the only option.
It seems like there's some really incredible opportunities, though, too. I remember I didn't do as much work with youth in the Neighborhood Support Coalition context as I did with adults, but I would wander between different neighborhoods maybe more than the people who lived in them did. And so, you know, I would meet people in a knitting circle in one neighborhood and then meet people in a crafting circle in another neighborhood, and they didn't know each other. They'd never met, they'd never communicated. And, you know, each one of these clubs would have 3 or 4 people, and you couldn't help but think, like, in a different world, if the logistics weren't so complicated, you'd have a 12-person knitting circle across the city. And it's like, that's what they'd have in common. And it's kind of nice that the neighborhood is diverse, and that the knitter is hanging out with the baker who's hanging out with the gardener, because that's your neighbors, as opposed to just hanging out with all the knitters. But, you know, there's also something to be said for, if you're online anyway, if we're stuck in these times, what can be embraced in this unique situation? And it's like maybe gathering all the kids that love soccer, regardless of neighborhood, and they have a place to geek out about that, you know, or complain about the lack of access to it.
Yeah. And one of the things that's always sort of saddened me about Guelph is how separate the city seems sometimes, how even if you're what I like to call the university bubble, if you're going to the university of Guelph, more than likely you're not interacting with the city of Guelph as a citizen. You're interacting with it as a guest, and so you don't take on the same sort of responsibilities. And we sort of see the same situation with the neighborhoods. People are very responsible to their neighbors, and they'll do anything for the people that live within the blocks of them, but then you start asking someone to do something over on the south end, and it's like, oh, you know, they're over there. So I'm hoping that the online access and the work of not just the GNSC, but the SEED and, you know, Hope House, all of these great organizations here in Guelph help to facilitate more interaction and not less, because it's really that community work that's helped to build that social security net that we have been able to rely on during this pandemic.
Well, it's neat. I don't know what the proper kind of metaphor image would be, but it's like there is this interconnection that is the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition. There is shared communication and a shared structure that the city's benefiting from. But when it's working at its best, you sort of don't notice it. You know, like it's not constantly being, look at the thing I gave you. It's like you just have the thing and that's awesome. And so I've had people tell me that they think that like their neighborhood doesn't have anything. And then they start to describe like, they're like, I don't know about this neighborhood support coalition. I haven't seen any evidence of it. And then I'm like, well, there's that. And they're like, oh, all of those are the neighborhood support coalition. I was like, yes, but you wouldn't know because they aren't putting their name and branding on every what should be basic service that you have access to.
Yeah. And it's like, I love working for the GNSC, but I would rather we walked around with giant shirts so that people understood the level of work that is done in order to create these social services and these access, instead of it sort of just existing, because when it gets taken away, people just go, well, where did it come from? And it's like, no, we needed your support the whole time it was there, not just when you lose it or when you gain it.
Yeah, well, like a sentiment I always bring up at the orientation sessions at CFRU is like, if you've seen our whole orientation presentation and you've listened to the radio and you've gone online and you haven't seen any evidence of a person like yourself, please don't interpret that as this is not for you. Interpret it as maybe your voice is missing from this conversation and we need you especially because you're missing, like your demographic is not reflected. And so similarly, like there could be 1,000 conversations that inform what a program looks like at the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition. But then when one person comes to the neighborhood who wasn't part of those conversations and their first experience is being left out, it would be so much more helpful if the response to that was like, no, like, let's have one more conversation and this one little shift and now you're included as well. But it's like you don't always know who you're not hearing from, or you don't know who has decided not to show up because the way it was described left them out. And it's complicated, those types of narratives, like how to present things.
And it's almost so complicated that some people draw away from it all the time. They like to only hear from the voices that they know will support them or that they're used to. But what I've seen in this pandemic is there's a lot more people who are willing to engage with community services than we had prior. And it's unfortunate that it took an emergency for that to happen to us, but at least that they did through word of mouth or through that communication. But you always tend to wonder, for every new person that has shown up, how many more people who could use the help have ceased or just not reached out at all. And that's where the real heartache starts to set in, because I can assure you that everyone at the GNSC would like to have a conversation with every single person who lives in Guelph so that we can service them a lot better. But you have to accept that some people won't talk to you, even if they are at the hardest part of their life. They won't reach out and just have that available for them. But it's a hard thing to accept. Yeah.
It's maybe a good segue to, I have two questions that I've kind of asked everybody, and one is around support. So I feel like especially folks who do the type of work you're doing with like a lot of different moving pieces, a lot of people it's hoping to support, have thought a lot about like, well, if there was just this thing implemented or just this thing rolled in terms of like, you know, funding or whatever, that you could see a whole group of people who are slipping through the cracks being supported. And I wonder if there's one of those you can think of, a burning had a desire for support to look a certain way that would be really helpful during this time.
Financial intelligence. The 2008 crash really redefined my life. We were a low-income family beforehand, but the opportunities to move out of low incomes completely disappeared after 2008. And from then on has been sort of a redefining moment in my life. And you would be hard pressed to find anyone in my age group who won't tell you the same thing. Even if their families were financially fine, the crash reshaped everything around us. And I feel as if this coronavirus is on the same vein, whether it be financially or even health-wise. Mm-hmm. But a lot more families are going to feel that financial impact than the health impact. And we don't have the financial intelligence to survive it. And it's like, it's been the most concerning thing for me as a person of color, but also as a young adult. I have my own personal financial journey that I have to go on. And I don't have any responsibilities. I don't have any kids. I don't own a house. I don't have a car. So I'm not too stressed about learning new things. But there are a lot of people who are about to experience financial hardship that they've never experienced before. And as a kid, that changes everything. That reshapes your understanding of yourself. It reshapes your understanding of the world. And it can change your mental health drastically. Really, it can. I always like to think of poverty as trauma, but poverty can be a trauma on its own without anything else added to it, because watching your parents cry over money is heartbreaking, because you can't do anything as a kid to solve it. Mm-hmm. So I wish financial literacy was a lot more accessible, not just in terms of, you know, making a budget and earning school, planning for retirement, estate planning, insurance planning, you know, how to help your kids get a car, things like that. A lot of families are just going off of older knowledge, not necessarily that they don't have any financial, they're going off of knowledge from 10, 15, 25 years ago that isn't applicable in a world that is moving towards remote jobs, you know, IT education, and very highly skilled service jobs as well, which is what I think the industry is going to come back to. So I wish we would be able to help facilitate financial literacy globally.
I think that's such a good point. I found going into some of the neighborhood groups was some of the first communities that I could geek out about poverty with the positive parts of how thrifty and how clever we were under certain circumstances. And it was like, I found my people. You understand why that's so exciting. And we were all talking about how, like, there's nowhere to be proud of this that didn't have just as many people be like, oh my gosh, that's how much money you make? That's so sad. Or like, oh, I'm so worried about you. And like, I wanted to be proud. I didn't want pity. And yeah, if you don't know how to talk about poverty, or how, you know, if you feel the pressure to pass and appear a certain way, especially if you are trying to save face for your children and you think that it needs to look a certain way. Yeah, there's just, it's just a bundle. And a lot of folks, it isn't until it's a reactionary move, right? It's like, there's the situation and now I have to suddenly realize what I'm going to do, as opposed to sending up like an infrastructure that can get you past those hurdles, right?
And generational wealth is a redefiner for a family, you know, being able to, even if you choose not to go to school, but being able to get a small lump sum of money when you're 18, because your parents have been saving throughout your childhood, can absolutely reshape someone's entire life. It's a great launching board. And I wish that access available, because even my mom worked, I don't think she ever earned above the average salary of 50K, but my mom was ready for me when I went to university, and it really helped with not taking on so many loans and helping me get my degree. And I'm like forever grateful that she had that foresight to know that you don't have to be making 100K or 200K a year to be able to take care of your family in the future. You just have to have financial literacy. And it's so unfortunate that it's not a stronger part of our education system.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. Yeah, and I think there's also something to be said for like involving your children in the decisions your family makes and why. That's been a big one for me, because I knew going into having my children, I wasn't going to have more money after having children. And so poverty had always been a lived experience for me, or at least low income. But we have a lot of privilege too, right? Like I always describe us as like low income with middle class privilege. Like we've got all kinds of privilege where we live, how our house presents, you know, and that makes a big difference. But you know, it telling my children why we've made certain decisions over other ones, and that, you know, we don't have this item that you covet that some of your classmates have. However, we went on this adventure together. Or, like, I get to be home with you more because I don't work more. And if I worked more, I might have more money for that thing, but you'd see me less. And just having them connect that, like, a childhood with their mom around a lot is part of why, you know, or them having to come to work with me, if that's the reality sometimes. It's like, well, that's because I work this type of job, but then you're with me. So, yeah, I think, like, the transparency, too.
And yeah. Just being able to frame it in the context of the world, because sometimes as a kid, you don't understand that you are impoverished or that you are experiencing poverty until you go to class and someone tells you. And
yeah.
Then that's no longer fun.
Yeah. Well, the other question I've been asking everyone is one around silver linings. So by no means suggesting that a global pandemic is not an awful and traumatic thing, but within it, things have emerged that are kind of bright spots or silver linings, I think. And I wonder if there's something you've seen emerge during this time that you're excited about and would love to see continued, even if we get to go back to some sort of version of normal.
I don't know if you saw the SpaceX launch. Amazing. I watched it and I was hoping that this was something that everyone would be able to watch and not just know about, because the ability to explore space is going to require a large effort. And I know we're watching the States do it, and we're kind of just assuming the States will commercialize it and we'll all get to go, but it's going to require an international effort. And I'm really happy that we're having these conversations around difficult social situations, because we're going to space and we're all going to need to be able to live with each other. So that's my silver lining. Is next 10 years, I assume it's going to be back to, you know, regular trips like how NASA was doing before they had their funding cuts. And I assume they're going to attempt to build a commercial space station. That would be the next logical jump in capitalist thinking in terms of space exploration, would be to build a form of generate income in space. I want to go shopping on a space station. I'm not going to lie to you. That would be super cool. And that does require us to deal with some of our more base level human interactions. So I'm glad that that's still happening. I'm really excited about it.
That's awesome. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'd just like to say that a pandemic as large spread as this one is going to have such long-term impact, not just on our day-to-day lives, but on the lives of our children and perhaps even the lives of our children's children. That's really scary. And I just like to remind people that it's okay to take a step back when those things get really scary and to enjoy the things that you enjoyed before this whole pandemic started. So, for example, I'm watching RuPaul. The new All-Star season came out, and it's very obvious for all of this. And, you know, no mask, no gloves, no cleaning, lots of touching. And it can feel really inappropriate to enjoy it because you know that this new world is going on and you know that the next season is going to be different. So as we go back into trying to reclaim our old routines, don't feel too guilty for missing the things that you like. Don't feel guilty about needing to set up new protocols with people. Just be aware that you're experiencing your feelings and be kind to yourself.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, I would love to keep talking forever, but I guess we're at over an hour, so it's probably best to wrap it. But thank you for having me. Oh, yeah. Thank you for making the time. It was really super fun to catch up.
I'm so excited you reached out. I'm really happy to see that CFRU is continuing, even during the pandemic. And I've been listening online as well to some of your previous broadcasts. You're an amazing interviewer. You're so easy to talk to. You do a phenomenal job. And I think I speak for everyone who encounters you, that you're such a great voice in the community. Thank you for all of the work that you do, even at home with your little ones, making time to interview me today. Phenomenal work, really.
Thank you. So once again, that was Chelsea Edwards, a programming coordinator at Parkwood Gardens Neighborhood Group in Guelph. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.
You're listening to C101.5 FM, The Hawk.